offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
Is Democracy Now!
We have documented Israel's perpetration of 3 out of the 5 prohibited acts under the Genocide Convention since the 7th of October. These include killing members of the group, causing them serious mental or bodily harm, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction.
Amnesty International has become the first major human rights organization to conclude Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. We'll speak to Amnesty's Israel-Palestine researcher. Then, All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera documentary, tells the story of Leon, a 13-year-old girl from Gaza who lost her leg in an Israeli strike.
The doctor told us we had to choose between the girl or her leg.
What happened to Leon weighs very heavily on me.
To make her feel better, I tell her it isn't just you. It's this kid, that kid, that kid, and that's just who we know.
Leon is one of over 1,000 Palestinian children who lost their limbs in Gaza in the first 2 months of the Israeli assault. Then to France, where President Emmanuel Macron is refusing to resign after lawmakers across the political spectrum united to oust his prime minister. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Syria, the leader of the powerful armed opposition group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, a former al-Qaeda affiliate, has declared opposition forces have taken complete control of the central city of Hama. In an interview with CNN published today, Abu Mohammed al-Jalani said his group's ultimate goal is to overthrow Syria's authoritarian president Bashar al-Assad. Armed groups now control Hama's military airport and were seen freeing prisoners from the city's jails. They've since pushed further south, claiming complete and rapid control of the northern suburbs of Homs, Syria's third largest city. Overnight, thousands of Homs residents fled toward Syria's western coast. On Thursday, Lebanon's Hezbollah movement pledged its support to the embattled Syrian government, which faces one of the largest challenges to Bashar al-Assad's authority in 13 years of bloody civil war. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Syrians displaced by violence are struggling to survive amidst freezing temperatures. This is Shafika Saida, a Yazidi Syrian whose family fled to a camp in northern Syria.
We were staying in Al-Shahba. They said the Free Syrian Army would enter the area. We were afraid because there were women with us. We were afraid that they would kidnap them from us. Our baby grandson was born on the third day here. We were sleeping outside. There was no tent or anything. We didn't find anything to eat when we got hungry, and there were no ovens to cook. The baby was born here, and we named him Afrin, after our city.
The Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza has again come under intense attack by Israeli forces who stormed the beleaguered hospital, making arrests and ordering others to evacuate. Kamal Adwan's director, Dr. Hassam Abu Safia, also reports many deaths and injuries from Israeli strikes, including 4 medical workers who were killed. Dr. Abu Safia, who himself was severely wounded in Israeli attack last month, called the situation catastrophic. In southern Gaza, a director of a soup kitchen in Al-Mawasi in Khan Yunis says many families rely solely on one meal per day from his operation after the World Central Kitchen paused its Gaza distributions following an Israeli airstrike that killed 3 more of its workers last weekend.
Now the ghost of famine is beginning to appear here in the southern Gaza Strip. These families can't afford even the low-priced materials and have no source of food except from this charity. Families are relying on this soup kitchen as their only means, as they have found their haven in it. Currently, we are serving more than 800 families, equivalent to approximately 4,000 people.
French President Emmanuel Macron dismissed calls to step down Thursday as he addressed the nation following the collapse of the French government in a no-confidence vote.
The mandate you democratically gave me is a five-year mandate, and I will carry it out fully until the end. We cannot allow ourselves to be divided or to do nothing. That's why I will name a prime minister in the coming days. I will ask them to form a government in the general interest, representing all the political parties who can participate in it, or at least who agree not to bring it down.
The leader of the Socialist Party met with President Macron today and urged him to meet with the heads of leftist parties as the president selects a new prime minister. We'll go to France later in the broadcast. On Thursday, Donald Trump tapped Rodney S. Scott, his previous head of Border Patrol, for Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, and Caleb Vitello as acting director of ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Trump's vowed to enact mass deportations as soon as he returns to office. In other transition news, President-elect Trump selected venture capitalist, former PayPal COO David Sacks, as his AI and crypto czar. The created position will require Senate confirmation or financial disclosures, though it's likely to directly benefit Sacks' various business interests in Silicon Valley. Sacks is a close ally of Elon Musk and is expected to push for more deregulation. In related news, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, tapped by Trump to run a proposed Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, met with Republicans on Capitol Hill Thursday to push plans to dismantle the federal government. New federal filings confirm Musk spent over $250 million to help elect Trump. The far-right Heritage Foundation, which created Project 2025, said it's spending $1 million to lobby Republican senators to confirm Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense amidst backlash over his history of sexual assault, misusing funds in his previous positions, possible ties to white nationalists, and various violations committed while drunk in public. He once yelled, "Kill all Muslims," while out at a bar during a work trip. Meanwhile, House Republicans on Thursday voted to block the release of Matt Gaetz's ethics report following an investigation into allegations that Gaetz was involved in the sex trafficking of an underage girl. He withdrew from consideration as Attorney General. Trump's transition team has prepared a list of countries to which it may deport asylum seekers when their home countries refuse to accept them. That's according to NBC News, which reports the arrangement could lead to hundreds of thousands of people becoming permanently displaced in countries where they have no connection to communities, language, or culture. On Thursday, the governments of the Bahamas and Turks and Caicos said they oppose Trump's deportation plans. Panama and Grenada are reportedly also on Trump's list. Meanwhile, an investigation by the Guardian newspaper finds the Biden administration has for the past year been in the process of extending at least 14 contracts with private sector immigration jails across the United States and exploring options for expanding detention capacity. That's despite Biden's past statements opposing for-profit prisons over their long record of human rights abuses. In climate news, a Biden administration official has told the International Court of Justice in The Hague that historical greenhouse gas emissions should not be considered wrongful acts. State Department legal advisor Margaret Taylor made the argument during a landmark climate case brought by low-lying island nations who face an existential crisis caused by wealthier polluting nations.
International human rights law, however, does not obligate states to mitigate anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. Nor does it currently provide for a human right to a healthy environment. Acts or omissions that preceded the crystallization of international obligations with respect to climate change cannot be internationally wrongful acts.
Representatives for China made similar arguments, saying UN climate change negotiations should be the only channel for global climate governance. That prompted sharp criticism from Vanuatu Special Envoy for Climate Change, who also called out the governments of Australia and Saudi Arabia for attempting to shrug off responsibility for historical emissions. In North Carolina, the town of Carrboro has filed a lawsuit against one of the country's largest electric utilities, accusing Duke Energy of contributing to global heating and lying to the public about the climate crisis. It's the first lawsuit of its kind in the United States. Plaintiffs say Duke Energy waged a deception campaign to hide the role of fossil fuels in exacerbating climate change, resulting in delayed action to curb the impacts of greenhouse gas pollution. The suit also alleges Duke continued to operate its coal and gas power plants despite learning about their harms nearly 60 years ago. Carrboro has faced intensifying extreme weather events, including catastrophic flooding. Duke Energy operates 6 power plants in North Carolina and is the third largest source of carbon dioxide in the United States. UN human rights experts are raising alarm over the criminal prosecution of 2 climate activists who were arrested in New York this summer during a series of nonviolent protests demanding an end to financing for the fossil fuel industry. Alex Conan and John Mark Rosendahl were taken into custody during protests against Citibank and criminally charged with assault and criminal contempt. The assault charge was later dropped, and both climate activists then pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of disorderly conduct. Rosendahl, who is a professional cellist, was arrested in August for performing a piece by Bach during a protest. In a victory for environmental activists, Norway's socialist lawmakers have temporarily halted Norway's plans to move forward with deep-sea mining in the Arctic Ocean by agreeing to support the government's 2025 budget in exchange for the pause. In January, Norway's parliament voted to allow deep-sea mining exploration in a swath of its Arctic waters about the size of the United Kingdom, which scientists warned would severely harm vulnerable ecosystems and even drive species to extinction. On Capitol Hill, police arrested over a dozen transgender advocates, including Chelsea Manning, as they staged a bathroom sit-in protest at a congressional restroom near the offices of House Speaker Mike Johnson and Congressmember Nancy Mace.
Our bodies are no debate!
Our bodies are no debate!
Speaker Johnson, Nancy Mace!
Speaker Johnson, Nancy Mace!
They chanted, "Our bodies are no debate." The protest, led by the gender liberation movement, came after Congressmembers Mace and Johnson imposed restrictions on transgender and non-binary people using congressional bathrooms ahead of trans Congressmember-elect Sarah McBride's swearing in next month. And the health insurance company Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield has reversed a new policy imposing time limits on coverage for anesthesia during surgeries in Connecticut, New York, and Missouri. The policy, which was set to go into effect in February, was announced in November but went viral earlier this week in the wake of the killing of UnitedHealthcare's CEO. The news provoked major outrage from the public, elected officials, and the medical community. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a landmark report released Thursday, Amnesty International has accused Israel of committing genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. It's the first time a major human rights organization's labeled Israel's actions in Gaza following the October 7th attacks of 2023 as genocide. This is a video released by Amnesty International to accompany its new report. "You feel like you are subhuman. Israel's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza" is the name of this video. It features Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard and their Israel-Palestine researcher, Boudour Hassan. It begins with a clip of former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant.
"We are laying complete siege on Gaza. No electricity, no food, no water, no fuel. Everything is closed. We are fighting human animals, and we act accordingly.
For over a year, we've witnessed utter carnage unfolding right before our eyes in the occupied Gaza Strip with no end in sight. Many have described this carnage as the first live stream genocide, day after day. What has your government done to prevent this genocide? What have your political leaders done? What are they doing now?
You feel like you are subhuman. Israel's genocide against Palestinians in Gaza.
Israel has been waging an ongoing and devastating offensive on the occupied Gaza Strip. More than 43,000 Palestinians have been killed and tens of thousands injured. Nearly 2 million displaced, neighborhoods flattened, aid and life-saving supplies restricted, all sparking an unprecedented humanitarian catastrophe. The term genocide has increasingly been used to describe Israel's conduct in Gaza. But how can we assess whether what is happening is actually genocide? The first treaty to explicitly define and criminalize genocide in international law was adopted by the United Nations in 1948 in response to the atrocities of World War II. To prove genocide has taken place, you need to show that one or more acts prohibited by the Genocide Convention was carried out and that it was committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, in this case, Palestinians.
As part of Amnesty International's research, we have documented Israel's perpetration of 3 out of the 5 prohibited acts under the Genocide Convention since the 7th of October. These include killing members of the group, causing them serious mental or bodily harm, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction. For example, this would include the destruction of essential infrastructure, including homes, agricultural land, water and sanitation infrastructure, and infrastructure indispensable to the civilian population. They also include the mass repeated displacement under inhumane and unsanitary conditions. And they also include the deliberate obstruction of entry of life-saving supplies and aid.
It is clear the Israel authorities have deliberately inflicted these conditions and knew they would inevitably result in a deadly mix of hunger and disease, which brings us to the other important component of the crime, the intent to destroy.
3, 2, 1.
It's an entire nation out there that is responsible. It's not true. This rhetoric about civilians not aware, not aware, not involved, it's absolutely not true.
These racist, dehumanizing, and genocidal statements call for the annihilation of Palestinians in Gaza and making Gaza unlivable. They provide evidence for Israel's intent to physically destroy Palestinians. As part of Amnesty International's research, we reviewed over 100 statements made by Israeli officials, and these statements clearly were echoed by Israeli soldiers on the ground.
Whoever returns here, if they return here after, will find scorched earth. No houses, no agriculture, nothing. They have no future.
Specific genocidal intent should be assessed through analyzing the most recent conflict, while taking into account a system of apartheid, a brutal occupation, and the 17-year unlawful blockade of Gaza, a history of systematic human rights violations built on the continuous dehumanization of Palestinians.
We have documented an unprecedented scale, speed, and seriousness of inhumane acts in Gaza. Palestinians are facing overwhelming trauma and pain. We have interviewed parents digging up the remains of their children with their own hands. And we have documented the mixture of hunger and disease that has ravaged Gaza, all while the healthcare sector has collapsed completely.
This must stop. And for genocide to end, governments around the world must come together and they must take action, resolute action. You must ask that they stop transferring weapons that are murdering children in their thousands and decimating entire Palestinian families. You must demand that justice be delivered, that all those responsible for the genocide be held to account. Perpetrators benefit from the inaction and the complicity of too many of our political leaders. No war criminals should ever be allowed to walk free, undisturbed, fearless. Let's put all our instruments into action. National tribunals, universal jurisdiction, international criminal court. Governments must do everything in their power to end Israel's genocide.
That's Amnesty International Secretary General Agnès Callamard, part of a video Amnesty released along with its 296-page report detailing Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza. Israel's rejected the charge of genocide, describing the report as, quote, fabricated and based on lies. This is Israeli Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs Sharon Haskell.
Amnesty International thinks that you're stupid because they think that in the 101 pages report that they actually produce, you will not read them. In this report, they actually altered and changed the legal terms and definition for what is a genocide because Israel doesn't meet those criteria. So Amnesty International had to alter it.
The U.S. State Department also said they, quote, disagree with Amnesty's report and continue to find allegations of genocide unfounded. For more on the report, we are joined by Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, Budur Hassan. She's joining us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. Budur, we saw you in this video report. If you can respond to what the Israeli government and the U.S. said and tell us more about why Amnesty has taken this position, the first among international major human rights organizations, that Israel's committing genocide in Gaza.
Thank you for having me again, Amy. Actually, if anything, why the question that should be asked, why did it take Amnesty this long to produce this report, not why we have adopted this approach in the first place? And one answer to that is, if anything, we try to be absolutely true to the definition of genocide under the Genocide Convention, but also to full suit with the jurisprudence on genocide, including the main decisions taken by the International Court of Justice on what is genocide. And because we are talking about strict and narrow definitions, our report and those who can read the legal section, and apparently the Israeli spokesperson failed to read that, we'll see that we absolutely adopt the definitions and the jurisprudence taken by the International Court of Justice, especially on the interpretation of what is specific intent. And in fact, this is why also it took us so long to produce this report, because we wanted to produce something that can be used by those who want to charge Israel with genocide. We wanted to produce strong enough evidence both for the commission of the prohibited acts under the Genocide Convention, in this case, killing Palestinians deliberately, inflicting them life-changing injuries, and inflicting upon them also destructive conditions of life that would cause their slow death. And we found that when we analyzed this conduct and we based our analysis both on evidence collected on the ground through our field workers who have been working tirelessly on the ground in Gaza since the 7th of October, and also on the analysis of satellite imagery, on the analysis of all publicly available evidence that we could reach, we found that these prohibited acts were indeed committed. And the next question was whether these acts were committed intentionally and with the specific intent to destroy Palestinians as a protected group or as such. And then we again followed the jurisprudence of the International Court of Justice, which is how you infer specific intent. You do infer it through two types of evidence. You do look at the pattern of conduct that the Israeli military has been adopting, which include the scale, severity, and seriousness of attacks, the repetition of the attacks, the cumulative effects of these attacks, the totality of evidence of the, that you can found on the ground. And secondly, you also looked at the direct evidence, which is the statements that we heard from Israeli officials. At Amnesty, we looked at more than 100 statements issued by Israeli officials, including 22 statements issued by high-ranking Israeli officials and military officers responsible for the war and security cabinets and responsible what is happening on the ground. We then looked at how these dehumanizing, derogatory, and racist statements that called specifically for the destruction and annihilation of Gaza, for equating Palestinians in Gaza, all of them, to Hamas, and for calling for the large-scale destruction of life in Gaza, we saw how these statements were echoed by Israeli soldiers. We verified 62 videos in which soldiers appear to be echoing these statements while celebrating the destruction of Palestinian universities, mosques, and agricultural lands.
I wanted to go directly to the U.S. State Department, who they have said they disagree with the conclusions of Amnesty's report. This is an exchange between reporters Prem Thakur and Saeed Erekat in the State Department press briefing with State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel.
What I can say as a spokesperson of the U.S. government and as a spokesperson of this administration is that the findings of the accusations of genocide, we continue to believe those to be unfounded. To
provide, so if you indulge me just a little
sure.
bit. I mean, look, we have seen almost 2 million people being forcibly moved from one place to another. This morning, Al-Mawasi was bombed, an area that Israel designated as safe haven for people to go to. They bombed it, they killed 20 people. What does it take? Does it have to the whole population of Gaza has to be annihilated for you to term it genocide? What are we waiting for on this issue?
Side, I'm just not going to get into this rhetorical hypothetical.
So we've seen the targeting of thousands of journalists, medical staff, humanitarian workers, infrastructure workers, the total decimation of agriculture, religious sites, homes, residential blocks, the destruction of neighborhoods, memories, bloodlines. Northern Gaza is ethnically cleansed to a great extent. Doctors, including from America, say that they've seen kids deliberately sniped. How many acts of genocide does it take to make a genocide?
So, look, I appreciate what you're trying to do with the way that you phrase that question, but let me just say again unequivocally that the allegations of genocide we find to be unfounded.
So that's State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel responding to journalists Prem Thakur of Zateo and Saeed Erekat of Al-Quds. If you can respond, Budur Hassan, as you sit there in the occupied West Bank, as you sit there in Ramallah, having just been a major part of producing this report of Amnesty International.
One question that was addressed was how long would it take for the United States to acknowledge the severity of what's happening in Gaza? The United States administration is not only denying that a genocide is happening in Gaza, it's denying that human rights violations are being committed by the Israeli authorities in Gaza. And we know, Amy, probably in 4 or 5 years' time, those very same people who are now denying that a genocide is happening, once they become retired officials, they will say, it happened under our watch and we did nothing to stop it. And they will probably give speeches in which they are awarded money in order to come and say, we knew that this was happening, we could not stop it. And unfortunately, this has been happening so often. And this is, if anything, it's a damning indictment of the United States' failure to stop Israel's violation. If there is any country that has the capacity, the power, and the tool to stop this genocide, is the United States. Not only has the United States failed to do so, it has consistently awarded Israel. It has consistently continued to flout the United States' own laws in order to continue giving Israel the weapons, the very same weapons weapons that are used by Israel to commit the genocide in Gaza.
You know, this reminds me of 30 years ago, almost exactly, when Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State and Bill Clinton was president, and they were continually challenged about what was happening in Rwanda. And they refused to use that term genocide, because if they did, well, can you talk about what it would mean, what it would trigger if they used the word genocide? And by the way, in that case, they would later apologize and say they were wrong.
But what would these apologies, how would these victims read these apologies?
Right, forget the apology.
And I think it's not only the guilt
of
the...
Forget the apology. Talk about what it would mean if they use the word genocide. What does that trigger internationally in terms of the world bodies at the UN and the response?
Obviously, considering that genocide is a crime under the ICC statute, and considering that we're talking about something that is absolutely prohibited, genocide is never justifiable, not even in an armed conflict, which means that those who continue to arm Israel while it is committing genocide are guilty of being complicit. And complicity is genocide is also prohibited under the Genocide Convention. So the states, part of why they are denying not only that genocide is being committed, but that war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity are also being committed, is that they don't want to risk being accused of complicity in these crimes.
Finally, Budur, you are in Ramallah. You're in the occupied West Bank. If you can talk about what's happening in the West Bank right now, with members of the war cabinet talking about wanting to annex the whole area, what is actually happening on the ground?
Not to deflect the question, Amy, but just because this report that we worked on was not just addressed to the international community or the court, it was mainly addressed to the victims. I would just ask you to give me just a couple of seconds, really, just to talk about the victims. We interviewed 212 people in Gaza, including victims of airstrikes, people who lost their entire families, agreed to speak to us to share their experiences, their grief. We went back to interview some of those we interviewed way back in October and November. We went back to interview them in October this year to tell them about the report. And we saw how even a year after a year had passed since they lost the entirety of their families, the scars of their loss never left them. One of the parents whom we interviewed again told us, I don't want people's sympathy. I want my children back. And we know that no one can really bring his children back. But he also added that at least what we can do and what I want you to do is to fight as hell for me to get the justice that my children deserve. This is a parent who lost his wife, all of his three children, his sister and his parents. And these stories happened all over again. We also talked to people who face daily humiliation while they are waiting on queues for bread, for clean water, for hours upon hours. People who were displaced repeatedly, some were displaced for 12 times. And if anything, why these people would agree to talk to you is because they are waiting for justice. It's because they believe that at least it is our duty to bear witness to the ongoing carnage and to name it for what it is, genocide. Now, concerning what's happening in the West Bank, I think all the attempts of Israel to annex more and more land from the West Bank, including through military orders, including through designating land in the West Bank and state land, it's part of Israel's onslaught and full-throttled onslaught on Palestinian existence on this land, on Palestinian memory, on Palestinian presence. This fight, this onslaught takes many shapes, many forms. In Gaza, we see it in the form of genocide. In the West Bank, we see it in the form of slow but really clear disposition and mass displacement. More than 300 households have been displaced in the West Bank since the 7th of October 2023. But what is common between these among this architecture of disposition, displacement, dehumanization, be it in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem or the Gaza Strip, is Israel's ongoing attempt, with the support of the United States, to erase Palestinians from this land.
Budur Hassan, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and also comment that today is the anniversary of the death of Rafat Al-Adir. He was killed 1 year ago today in an Israeli strike. His last tweet, "The Democratic Party and Biden are responsible for the Gaza genocide perpetrated by Israel." Rafat Al-Adir is known around the world. He was a professor at Islamic University and an award-winning poet. Budur Hassan, thank you so much for being with us. I'm an Amnesty International researcher on Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. We will link to Amnesty's report, which has just concluded Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza. The report is called "You Feel Like You're Subhuman, Israel's Genocide Against Palestinians in Gaza." Next up, All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera documentary, follows a 13-year-old girl named Leon from Gaza, who lost her leg in an Israeli attack. She is now in Philadelphia, one of 1,000 child amputees in just the first 2 months of the Israeli attack on Gaza. Stay with us.
نامي يا فرحة أيامي نامي نامي خيت نامي نامي يا فرحة أيامي بكرة تضحكي عنا تحكي بكرة تضحكي عنا تحكي والجنة تحقق.
Nami Lullaby by the Lala Bu Amna. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to a grim statistic from Gaza. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said Gaza now has the highest number of child amputees per capita anywhere in the world, with many children forced to endure surgery without anesthesia. In September, the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, said each day in Gaza, 10 children are losing one or both of their legs. Last weekend, after months of waiting for approval from Israel, 8 injured Palestinian children from Gaza arrived in Chicago for medical treatment. It was the largest medical evacuation of injured Palestinian children to the United States. We turn now to a new film from Al Jazeera's Fault Lines that brings this story to life. It's called All That Remains. It follows the story of Leon Abu Alata, 13-year-old girl whose leg was amputated after she was severely injured in an Israeli strike on Deir al-Balah in Gaza last December.
Leanne was like a butterfly. She flew here and there. She was very active and didn't like to stay put.
Leanne loves fashion. She loves to dress up.
Today, I have for you a poem by Tamim al-Barkuti.
She likes to write. She recites poetry.
In Jerusalem, graves are arranged as if they are lines of the city's history. Hi guys, I'm getting ready for school because we have a test. Math.
Leanne was injured on Saturday, December 2nd.
Check this out, people. This is after I got myself ready.
The doctor told us we had to choose between the girl or her leg.
What happened to Leanne weighs very heavily on me.
To make her feel better, I tell her it isn't just you. It's this kid, that kid, that kid, and that's just who we know.
I took her cell phone to see what she used to film. I wanted to see how she used to be because I was so sad for her. What touched me when I saw her videos was that she was so ambitious. She was excited about the future and loved to document everything. This made me feel I wanted to see her like she was before, not confined to a bed.
I was awake, but I felt like I was in a dream. It didn't feel real. My name is Layan Ali Musa Abu Al-Atta. I'm in Egypt, and we're getting ready to go to America tomorrow.
That's 13-year-old Layan Al-Atta. In this next clip from the Fault Lines documentary, All That Remains, Layan's parents and her older brother describe what happened after she was injured in this Israeli strike on Deir al-Balah.
It was like Layan was fading away before our eyes. And we were watching our hopes and dreams being destroyed.
Her leg looked almost amputated. The doctor told us that the majority of her leg's tendons were cut. 10 to 15 centimeters of her bones were missing.
There wasn't any equipment for the doctors to perform proper surgery. The doctor came out and said that the girl was in very bad condition. It was clear on his face. I had a high fever that never went away, and my leg suddenly turned black and blue. I can't breathe. Enough already. We didn't know what to do. The girl was dying.
That's a clip from All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary. Layan is now in Philadelphia. She's being treated at Shriners Hospital. For more, we're joined from Washington, D.C. by Rana Natur. She's the director and producer of All That Remains. Rana, this is a devastating film. Yes, it's the story of one little girl and her unbelievable courage. But take us on that journey from the day last December when she was injured in this airstrike, and then how she and her mom got out of Gaza to Egypt and ended up in Philly.
You know, Layan was injured in an airstrike, in an artillery strike on a mosque that happened to be by the school where she was sheltering. And it changed the trajectory of her life forever and her loved ones and her family's life, but it didn't even register on international media's reporting because of all the massacres that were going on. And after that strike, her family saw that her leg was at risk of being amputated. And they couldn't get the care they needed to get the medical care to prevent that amputation from happening. So her brother, her older brother, Ayub, launched a social media campaign. He reached out to every journalist in Gaza in an effort to make a public plea to get his sister out of Gaza. And they were successful, but it was too late. Her leg was amputated because gangrene had reached up to her leg and was going to kill her if she didn't amputate that leg. And Layan, for every Layan that is able to leave Gaza, there are hundreds, if not thousands, who are not able to leave. A medical evacuation out of Gaza and her eventual medical evacuation to the U.S. for medical treatment, it's what I call a lucky ticket for the profoundly unlucky. But it was the best shot that Layan had at a future. It was the best shot that Layan had for the chance, even just the chance to be able to walk again on prosthetics.
So her leg was amputated in Cairo, because the gangrene threatened her life when she got out of Gaza. Her mother making this devastating decision to leave her other children and her husband, who remain under, to say the least, in enormous danger in Gaza, but to be with Leon.
Yes, exactly. These evacuations are essential because the medical system in Gaza is collapsing. But what this does is it means that these families are ripped away from their support system at the exact moment they need it most, when they have a very sick child that needs medical treatment. At the beginning of this journey of making the film, we thought we were following a medical journey. We wanted to know all about her treatments, and we realized soon after that this was about more than that. That this was not just about a girl who wanted to walk again, but that this was about a girl who wanted to make sure that her life didn't go unlived, that she didn't just languish in a hospital bed, and that this was a journey and something that changed the entire trajectory of this family. Every single member of this family's life changed as a result of this injury. Her mother had to make the decision. She did not want to leave Gaza, but she had to try to save her daughter's life, essentially. She left behind an 8-year-old boy who suddenly didn't have a mom. She left behind her husband, who remains in Gaza today, and we were able to document, with the help of Media Town Productions, who documented the family that Leanne left behind, this 360-degree perspective of what this injury did, because it's not just an injury that's physical to one girl, but it's a traumatic injury of separation for an entire family.
I wanted to go to another clip from your documentary, Rana, All That Remains, where we hear from the renowned surgeon, Dr. Hassan Abusita, who spent more than a month in Gaza working with Doctors Without Borders in the early days of Israel's assault there.
So this is a photo that I took of our operating room after I finished. And the anesthetist is waking the child up, and one of the nurses is writing the child's name on the box that has their amputated limb. And you could see the box where the limb is in. This is a limb that's unsalvageable and needed amputation. This is a surgery that I did on the hand to try to salvage the limb. This is a 14-year-old boy called Ramadan. So there are lots of reasons why I take these photographs. Sometimes the memories are so horrendous that you need to see it to believe that it did happen. It was really the scale. So the scale of children's amputations, half of my cases were always children. The delay that was happening in taking patients to the operating room meant that these wounds became infected and gangrenous, and you had to do amputations to save the children's lives. And as the war progressed and children knew of other children who'd lost their limbs, they would come to the operating room screaming, "Don't take my leg away, don't take my leg away." Children are not small adults. There's a difference in the way you treat them. The child's body is programmed to grow. Even the injured child's body is programmed to grow. A child that has a war-related amputation needs between 9 and 12 surgeries by the time they reach adult age. This growing child needs a new prosthetic every 6 months as their body outgrows the length of the prosthesis. This problem is so complex, so you need to create a system that ensures that these children have the most productive life possible. It is of paramount importance that we continue to plan for tomorrow, because genocide is about there not being a tomorrow. There is a tomorrow for these children. And our job is to make sure that they do not spend the rest of their lives in pain and misery as a result of this injury.
That's renowned surgeon Dr. Hassan Abusita, who spent more than a month in Gaza working with Doctors Without Borders. You can see our interviews with him at democracynow.org. But that's from the film All That Remains, that's produced and directed by Rana Natour. So let's talk about the number of Palestinian children who have lost their limbs. In fact, you document in a piece that you write, Rana, you told the story of another teenager, little young girl named Leon, also, who lost both her limbs. The Leon who is in this documentary is at Shriners in Philadelphia right now. And Leon Albas is at Shriners in Chicago. Rana.
That's correct. And I think when I first started reporting on this issue, I thought that the mountain that these kids were climbing medically was getting them access to a prosthetic limb and making sure that they had specialized care from specialized doctors who would be able to make that all happen. What I soon learned with the story of Leanne Albaz, which I document in the Atavist magazine, is that these injuries are incredibly complicated and difficult to treat in the best of circumstances, even before these specialists that are renowned throughout the entire world. And why? The reason is because, A, children historically didn't typically survive these injuries. And they are surviving multiple very severe and complicated injuries. To give you an idea of Leanne Albaz, she has an above-the-knee amputation on one knee and a below-the-knee amputation in another knee. That she had limbs that she's a victim of a blast injury. So these limbs have been eviscerated. The limbs, the bones, the muscles, the tissue, the tendons, the skin. There's a specialist for each of those things because they all have to work together in order to accommodate a prosthetic. And when she finally was able to walk on a prosthetic, I was able to witness what that therapy looks like. She's operating basically two different instruments at the same time. She has to learn how to master two different instruments because she has a mechanical knee on one side and she has a prosthetic that looks completely different on the other side because the injuries look completely different. It is very, very, very difficult.
So we have to wrap up right now. We have 30 seconds. The documentary, All That Remains, just utterly heartbroken with the divided family. And the strongest figure in this film is this little girl, is Leanne, who is comforting her mother, who came with her, her dad, who's still in Gaza, her brothers. Her spirit is astounding.
It absolutely is. I mean, these kids survived bombs being dropped on them, buildings falling on them, shrapnel ripping through their body, and they survived all of this, and they still have the fight to fight for their future and demand they have one. It sounds like it's a depressing story, but I promise you it's a hopeful one.
Rana Nathur, I want to thank you for being with us, director and producer of the Fault Lines documentary, All That Remains, and all should see it. We'll also link to your article in Atavist called Coming to America. Coming up in 20 seconds, we go to France, where President Macron is refusing to resign, even though lawmakers across the political spectrum have united and ousted his prime minister. Back in 20 seconds.
Much unhappy about that. I hate to come down to the level and become a BW, a basic woman. But if they don't stop, it's gonna get scandalous. Uh-oh. I don't need this.
I'll be back real soon.
That's what I get for being in the neighborhood.
Got a meeting in the ladies' room.
Where's my jewelry? Can we talk?
I don't know, but I think you better watch your man.
Better watch your man.
Meeting in the Ladies' Room by Climax. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to France, where it is in political turmoil after leftist and far-right lawmakers united to oust Prime Minister Michel Barnier in a no-confidence vote Wednesday. The vote came amidst intense opposition to Barnier's budget proposal and its roughly $60 billion in spending cuts and tax increases, the first time France's government has fallen to a no-confidence vote since 1962. On Thursday, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, rejected calls to resign, said he'll soon name a new prime minister.
Nous ne pouvons nous permettre ni les divisions.
We cannot allow ourselves to be divided or to do nothing. That's why I will name a prime minister in the coming days. I will ask them to form a government in the general interest, representing all the political parties who can participate in it, or at least who agree not to bring it down.
We're joined now from Marseille, France, by Cole Stangler, journalist covering politics and labor issues in France. His most recent book, Paris is Not Dead, Surviving Hyper-Gentrification in the City of Life, in the City of Light. Thank you so much, Cole, for being with us. Talk about what's taken place. This is historic.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Like you said, it's the first time that we've had a government fall to a motion of no confidence since 1962. This is the shortest lived government really in the history of the Fifth Republic. And we're in this unprecedented situation of turmoil. And I think, you know, we could look back for deeper reasons to try to understand the political crisis that France is in. But if you want to look at it a little bit more simply, you know, this comes down to really two big factors here. One is we have to go back to President Macron's decision to dissolve the National Assembly this summer, a move that might go down as, you know, probably one of the greatest own goals, let's say, in French political history. So Macron, when he dissolved the National Assembly, what that meant is we went to new elections. And in those new elections, the far right National Rally increased its share. Macron's party decreased its share. And so it left a situation which we had three main blocks in the National Assembly, none of which was able to form a majority of their own. So Macron lost his relative majority in the National Assembly by calling for those elections. And then secondly, again, to get back to Macron's responsibility here, secondly, the crisis has its roots in the way that Macron responded to those elections. So like I said, after those elections, we had three blocks in the National Assembly, the left bloc, the New Popular Front, with a slight lead on the rest, but basically three evenly split blocks. And instead of turning to the voters expressed at the polls, which was the support for the center and for the left, Macron decided to name a prime minister on the right. So a prime minister that did not actually reflect what voters expressed at the polls. So it's really those two big issues to simplify. It's one, Macron's decision to call those elections in the first place, which backfired, decreased his party share in the National Assembly. And secondly, the fact that this government here that's fallen did not reflect what voters actually expressed at the polls earlier this summer.
So Barnier is a former EU official. He's been forced to step down as prime minister. The president says he's going to name a new prime minister. Can you talk about who exactly he's talking to? You have everyone from Marine Le Pen on the far right to Mathilde Panot, leader of the left-wing France Unbowed party. And Marine Le Pen, who now faces a verdict in a criminal embezzlement case in the next months, which could potentially make her ineligible to run for office for years. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And that also might be part of the reason why there's calls to move to a presidential election in certain parts of the far right. But you know, the key issue here is we still have the same mathematical problem that we had after the elections this summer, which is how do you find a prime minister that's able to get enough support in the National Assembly, or that's able to at least withstand a motion of no confidence. So you have to get someone who cannot have 289 members of the National Assembly vote against them. That's really the goal here. And the question is Macron going to basically try to do the same thing that he did this summer, which is to say, I'm going to turn to the right and de facto let the National Rally be the one that's going to decide whether or not to let have the government stand or not? Or is he going to turn to the left? That's what the members of the National, the New Popular Front, the left-wing coalition have been calling for. But to be quite frank, Amy, if you look at the way that Macron spoke last night, it doesn't seem like we're going to have a change of tack. It doesn't seem like we're moving that Macron wants to name a left-wing prime minister. But again, the main situation here is at a certain point, it's not really Macron's decision to make. We have a mathematical problem. France needs to have a government, and you have three pretty evenly split blocks. So at some point, that mathematical reality requires choices to be made.
And finally, Cole Stangler, you have President-elect Trump going to France in his first international trip since he was reelected president for the reopening after the fire of Notre Dame Cathedral.
Yeah, I mean, the timing there is quite remarkable, because we have a president now, you know, President Macron. I mean, like, you could maybe say that both these presidents are in very different, or future president in the case of Trump, in different situations. Macron is increasingly isolated, extremely unpopular. If you look at his
we have 10 popularity seconds.
Extremely unpopular president, increasingly isolated. So Macron not in a very favorable position right now.
Cole Stangler is a journalist speaking from the French city of Marseille, and we'll link to your articles. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Anjali Comet, Renee Felt, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias, our executive director, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The Museum of Lenox in Addington invites you to join them over the holidays, celebrating Friday Night Lights on Friday, November 29th, December 6th, and December 13th. Stop by the museum between 5 to 8 p.m. each night for a free visit, live music, open galleries, festive crafts with local artists, and the creation